Good morning, everybody. Happy Monday. You know that song, Rainy Days and Mondays, always get me down. Let's see if music will cut. There it is. And we're having a tech problems today. Rainy Days and Monday is always get me down. Remember that one? Well, we've got a rainy Monday here in Maine today. And it might even be raining where my guest is down in New Haven, Connecticut, Dr. Sally Shaywitz from Yale, who's a miracle worker, expert on dyslexia and learning, along with her husband, who's also an MD. These are MDs, by the way, but Dr. Bennett Shaywitz is not with us. Sally is an expert on dyslexia. And I did a show last week with a group called Learning Ally via EdWeb, and I got to tell you, it was an incredible show. It opened my eyes, and I can't wait to talk to Sally today. I apologize, by the way, to anybody who tuned into our 9 a.m. show that we had a system-wide breakdown from Blog Talk Radio, and it just would not let us log in as hosts, so we're going to reschedule that show with those three wonderful Texas superintendents, and I was so happy that had been fixed by the time Sally's show was on. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org and tweet it out over at EduTalk Radio. Please follow us over there if you're not already. We'd love to have you get a direct link before and after every show so it's easy to listen. I got to thank my friends at Pearson for putting together today's show, along with my good buddies, Glynis and Lisa over at Lisa Wolf Communications for helping me get Dr. Shaywitz here. I have a feeling is a very busy lady, so let's bring her on.
No, I'm here.
Sally?
Yes.
Sally?
Good morning.
It's Larry.
Yes.
good morning.
Yes. I'm here incognito, but I am here, and I'm delighted to be here with you this morning and happy things are working.
Well, I'm thrilled. And, you know, I was reading your bio over at let me read it here so everybody knows. It's the Yale Center, which is an interesting title for dyslexia and creativity. Okay, and you run that along with your husband, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz. You're both MDs, which greatly impressed me. When I first saw that you were doctors, I thought you were, which is great too, a doctorates in education, but you're both MDs. How'd you get interested in dyslexia? That's interesting for an MD.
Well, yes, it is. Well, we're clinicians and we take care of people, but we're also physician scientists, so we do research. And my husband is a pediatric neurologist who for many years served as chief of child neurology, and I'm a developmental pediatrician. And I began to see children and brought in by their parents because they have difficulties in school. And it was so shocking. Here are these cute little kids, you know, at the beginning of school, and you know how it is as a parent. You have all these dreams, and you tell the child, school is going to be great. Oh, you're going to love to learn to read. And then I'd see these forlorn children and these desperate parents. And we decided, well, what's going on? So we began a body of research to try to find the answer and to use that knowledge to actually help the children.
And let me just, by the way, Dr. Shaywitz is the author of many articles, and she's a world-renowned expert. But you also wrote, I know you know this, Sally, but I want to make sure everybody knows this, from 2003, it's called Overcoming Dyslexia, basically a national bestseller and a Bible of dyslexia. Overcoming Dyslexia,
yes,
a new and complete
science-based
program. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just wonderful what you're doing out there. Do you see... what do you see on? I'm curious about this. I'll tell you a funny story. When I was in teacher education, and I graduated college in 1969. Don't buy math. I'm 69. Okay. So at any rate, okay. But when I was in teacher education, I literally, and I was going to be a history teacher, which I was, but I literally never heard the word dyslexia. Okay, when I was in college, and I didn't even hear the word to my memory, and I'm remembering the conversation way back with a guidance counselor at the school I taught at who mentioned it, and I said, I don't know what that is. And what's going on in dyslexia today? Obviously, people are more aware of it, but it seems to me there's a lot of kids with it, but how are we on the horizon, and is it fitting in? I'm just curious, the teacher training.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head. Dyslexia was actually first described by a British physician. Are you sitting down? In 1896, He described Percy, a 14-year-old boy, who'd be the brightest in his class, except he didn't read well. And you would think, it's over 100 years, people would talk about it, but to my shock, educators don't know about it. It's really an incredible thing. So there's a huge need to make the public aware, because do you know how prevalent it is?
No, I don't. Actually, I don't. How prevalent is it? As the old Johnny Carson line goes, how prevalent is it?
It's very prevalent. It affects 1 out of 5 people. That's 20% of the population.
Does it cut across racial? That kind of thing.
I'm so glad you asked that question.
Okay.
It cuts across racial, ethnic, gender, whatever you want to call it. For example, I wrote my book obviously in English, which is an alphabetic language, and it's been translated in Italian, Portuguese, etc. But do you know what else? What really shocked me, it's been translated into Chinese, Korean, and Japanese, and they're all what's called logographic languages. They use different alphabets, so it's universal. We've had calls from people all over the world, in the Arab countries, in Europe, in Asia, everywhere. So isn't it incredible that it's so common, and people in our own schools in the United States don't know about it?
It's frightening. It's more than incredible. It's absolutely frightening that is the case. When I think of dyslexia, and I still remember this conversation from so long ago, I said, what's dyslexia? And the guidance counselor was a great guy, said, well, it means they read backwards. End of discussion. Right. Define it. Define dyslexia. You're the expert.
Oh, it's my pleasure to do that.
And
you should know that there was a unanimous resolution passed by Senator Cassidy and Barbara Mikulski. They brought it up in 2015, defining dyslexia as an unexpected difficulty in reading for an individual who has the intelligence to be a much better reader. And it's due to a difficulty in getting to the individual sounds of spoken language, which affects the ability of an individual to speak, to read, to spell, and importantly, to learn a second language. So
For all the ESL kids. Oh, my God. Dyslexic ESL kid. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, all kids. It affects the richest of the rich, the poorest of the poor, and everyone in between. One of the difficulties is that dyslexia is a paradox. It's a difficulty getting to the sounds of spoken words, as I just read you as part of the definition. So people don't read well. And in fact, they read slowly, which they can't help, but with good comprehension. On the other hand, they have often great intelligence, insight, reasoning abilities, ability to do analysis. So we always expect, if you have a disability, it's all this. But in the case of dyslexia, you can have brilliance and you can have difficulties. So there's no outward sign. And people have this mistaken notion that if you read slowly, you must think slowly. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. In dyslexia, you read slowly, but you think quickly. And in fact, in October of 2015, we had an incredible conference at Yale. We called it Slow Readers, Fast Thinkers, It Takes a Dyslexic Brain. And were some of the dyslexic people who were on our panel?
No, I do not.
Okay.
Who were they?
Attorney David.
It's like
Boyd.
A Johnny Carson thing. Who were they, Sally?
Okay. I love your questions, Larry. renowned attorney David Boyce is dyslexic. Incredible surgeon and CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Toby Cosgrove.
Oh, my God.
Talent manager, Ari Emanuel. the man, producer, Brian Grazer, and very well-respected economist, Diane Swank. So these are all dyslexic people, but they're also brilliant. And they spoke about, very poignantly and very openly, about how difficult it was when they were children.
Sure.
Even though now they're each at the top of their professions. It's very clear that in this country, we have a reading crisis. If you look at the data, as Dr. Bennett-Shaywitz and I do, you see for the poorest readers, it's getting worse and worse. So we have a reading crisis. And all the evidence points to that both the explanation and the solution are pointing to dyslexia. The problem is it's not being identified by schools. If you ask a school, oh, how many dyslexic children do you have? They'll say, huh, what? Oh, we don't count them. We don't have any. But if you do a study and you evaluate each child, then you find that it's incredibly common, affecting boys and girls of all backgrounds, living in all places. So that's why we've gone ahead and looked at all the data and said, we need to, this is very important. In November, we published a paper. Let me give you a little background. I direct a study called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study, which is a population-based study. So it's not this group or that group. It's representative of the population. And this study has been going on a very long time. Very long time. So we looked at our data, and that's how we know that there is 20% who are dyslexic. And you know what we found, Larry? You listen, everybody should listen carefully, because what we found was that the gap between typical readers and dyslexic readers was already present in first grade.
And
it didn't go away.
And of course, kids have to meet reading level. That third grade is kind of when we really look at this.
Exactly.
Okay?
But it's too late.
Yeah, but let me ask you, Sally, when a kid gets to third grade, and let's say they're pretty intelligent, the teacher knows that, but they're not reading well. Maybe the teacher doesn't know it, but they're not reading well. Are enough schools testing kids at that point to find out the reason why they might be behind, or is it just they're just dumb?
It not really, because what happens, and I've spoken to, you know, tons of dyslexic people, and in my book I write about, for example, the writer John Irving, who's dyslexic. And
really?
The teacher would say, yeah.
Wow.
So what people think about dyslexia isn't what really is. So the point is, the teacher will say, you're not trying hard enough, or I guess you're not so smart. And so what must be done, given that the achievement gap is so early, we have to identify children early. And one important way of doing it is to screen all the children for dyslexia. And to do that, you can do it. We've developed an instrument, the Shaywitz Dyslexia Screen, that allows you, a teacher, because we looked at all the materials and everything, nobody's taken advantage of the teacher who works with the child day in, day out, and knows the child best. So we've developed, based on a longitudinal study, we know what are the best predictors of dyslexia. So very simple, a 10-item kindergarten questionnaire that takes the teacher 5 minutes to fill out, and alternately a first grade 12-item. So they're sensitive. They're very easy to do. They have very, very good, what we call psychometric data, and they're inexpensive. So there's no excuse not to screen all the children. And then when you identify who's at risk, then you could, I think the best thing is then to go and do a full diagnostic evaluation, but only on those children that the screener identifies at risk.
Wait a minute, Sally. So let's just say they find a child, which they'll find 20%, to be quite honest. They'll find 15-20% of the kids are going to be dyslexic, just on taking that on average. All right? And
okay.
Let's say we do that with the child and enters public kindergarten or first grade or whatever. Then the question, you wrote your book again, Overcoming Dyslexia, but then my question is, now what? Are the teachers, who's trained to take it one step further and help these kids get over this barrier?
Well, that's what we're working on, but schools have school psychologists who can then do a full diagnostic evaluation. But what this means is it has a high payoff because you've screened all the children, so you know children you don't need to do the evaluation, but you also know the children that you must do it, because if the once the diagnosis is made following screening, the whole door's open and the light shines in. Then children, there are very, very good approaches to remediating dyslexia, and the data show the earlier the better. And it's also important for the child. You know, one friend of mine said, what does a child feel like when they're suddenly in school and they can't do what everybody around them can do? So you have the child, one, know what he has, that it has a name, and that he's not dumb. That's incredible, and that there's a community of other dyslexic students that he or she belongs to. And in fact, there are now wonderful public charter schools for dyslexic students, so they don't feel so isolated, because they're often very, very bright. So, and there are efforts now, many states have laws encouraging the identification of children who are dyslexic, and our Department of Education has a What Works clearinghouse, and that simply means that different intervention programs are reviewed, and those that have evidence are then recommended, and the child can have it. You need small groups, you need to meet frequently, and you can't be fooled if they show, well, they're improved a little. This is a long-term thing. This is a marathon, not a sprint. But you can win the race. You know, I named you some of the brilliant people, successful people.
Yes, you did.
Who are dyslexic.
Which brings up a question. Which brings up a question I have, which is to me very interesting. The people you named, obviously, are all bright, successful people. Are dyslexic people more intelligent than the average bear, so to speak?
I can't say that. I can say two things, though, and I think they're important. One is, we did a study as part of our longitudinal study, and we looked at the relationship of IQ and reading, you know, intelligence and reading in typical readers. And we found that they're dynamically linked. I don't like jargon, so let me say it in English. What we found that over time, intelligence and reading go together. So if you're highly intelligent, you'd probably be a really good reader. And if you're a really good reader, you're probably going to be highly intelligent. And that's why most people in the population think, well, if you don't read very well, well, you can't be too smart. But we're kind of clever people.
Wow.
And what we did was we did the same testing on dyslexic people. And when we did that, we found something very different. We found that you can have a very high level of intelligence, but not read so well. And that's where the validation of the unexpected nature of dyslexia, that's really, really important. What we have to do now is make sure the public, the teachers, admissions counselors, people who are hiring at different occupations, know that. Some of the brightest attorneys, I mentioned David Boies, physicians, I mentioned Toby Cosgrove, and many other financiers, Charles Schwab, are all dyslexic.
Huh.
And you wouldn't have known that. You wouldn't have guessed that. And
but
it's
how
very
did they overcome that? These people are all, I'm going to say, in their 50s and 60s, the people you named. Okay, right. I mean their age, 50s and 60s. And back when they went to school, which was when I went to school in, no pun intended, the 50s and 60s, okay, there was a lot less known about dyslexia. How, and you're the, like I said, you wrote the book, Overcoming Dyslexia. How does a guy like John Irving, who, by the way, was born and raised in Exeter, New Hampshire, where I my kids were born and raised. We lived right around the corner from his house, okay, which was very cool. We bragged about that a lot. But the great author, John Irving, how does he manage to write 20 novels and overcome this in an age of 50s and 60s education? And by the way, he did go to Phillips Exeter, okay, but I don't know how,
yes,
you know, you start that in high school.
I think his father or stepfather was head there.
But,
he
still had dyslexia. He was still dyslexia.
Yeah.
He was still dyslexia.
And I'll tell you what he'll tell you. One of the biggest helps to him was that he found...
Sally?
He found
you're
something...
Lost. Oh,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, no, here I am.
Go ahead.
Can't lose me that easy. So so what he found is that finding something he could do and he could do well was very, very important in keeping his hopes alive and keeping his self-esteem. And you know what he does that gave
wrestling.
Him such confidence?
I know he was a wrestler.
Exactly. And I had the privilege with my husband of visiting his home in Vermont at the time I was writing my book.
Cool.
And you know what he has in his house? A wrestling ring.
No.
Yeah, great. Charles Schwab, golf. So there are people who found something, and I'd advise it to people who are listening out there. Find something you or your child can find satisfaction and confidence in. And in fact, I was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal a week or two ago just about this issue, and this is exactly what I said. I think that's really important. And one other thing, looking at families, each person has someone who really believes in them, who supports them. Brian Grazer talked about his little 4'10", I think, grandmother, who, when things were going difficult, always said to him, you're going to succeed. You know why? Because you're curious. I see it. Don't lose your curiosity. Each one of the people had someone, often it's a mother, but it could be a grandmother, it could be someone else, who believes in them. And when things seem to be going downhill, they reinfuse that confidence. But now that we're in the 21st century, we have knowledge. I testified to the Senate in U.S. Senate Help Committee in May, and what my message was that science, we always want more knowledge, but in the case of dyslexia, we have sufficient knowledge. So we don't have a knowledge gap. We have an action gap. We have to put the knowledge we have, the scientific knowledge, and it's quite a lot, we have to put it into action. We have to bring education and 21st century science together.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that is to get schools engaged. And a first step, it's so easy, screen all children, whether it's kindergarten or first grade, for dyslexia.
And it's not expensive to do. I have a curiosity, though. You're a professor at Yale, a lucky Yale.
Yes, I am.
And you and Dr. Bennett, your husband, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, are professors
at
Yale. All right.
Yes.
Yale has a school of education. Okay.
No.
And they don't.
No.
Oh, I thought they did. Okay, let's go over to Harvard then. Okay. Are you talking to the professors at the universities? I mean, you're close to a lot of universities down there, okay, and through Massachusetts, et cetera. Are they getting teacher prep and future administrators involved in this? Have you had those conversations? Because
some people. I can't say we've had it with those at Harvard, but we know them and they know us.
Well, you guys compete, Harvard and Yale. Harvard and Yale compete.
Sorry?
So that's okay. Harvard and Yale compete, so that's okay. Ignore them.
But
they have,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said that Harvard and Yale compete all the time, so that's okay. We can ignore them, but all the other colleges.
We compete, but we admire and respect each other, and knowledge should be shared. It's a new world. One other thing I really should mention.
Yeah.
What education hasn't had previously is evidence. When you look at the programs that have been used to teach children to read,
yep.
they're often based on myth or, oh, I believe in it, or, you know, something, but not scientific evidence. For example, in medicine, we have an FDA. Before a drug can be marketed, there has to be studies that compare this medication to another one in a randomized double-blind controlled study, and you see which actually worked, which was most effective. That's evidence. That never happened in education, but there is now what's called the What Works Clearinghouse. That's part of the U.S. Department of Education, the Institute for Educational Sciences, and now they are reviewing studies to see, does the study meet criteria? Is it a valid study? Can we take what the outcome of the study is as reliable evidence? Our children only have one life to live. We can't say, oh, here, we'll teach you at this, and then it turns out to be not effective. You know, dyslexia is lifelong. We need to get to children early and intervene with programs that work. That becomes incredibly important.
We do, and as you're saying, and everybody, I think, pretty much agrees with this, early identification is the key. Okay.
Exactly.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I think I'm correct. My good friends over at Pearson. Are you working with Pearson? What are you doing with them that's going to help with early identification?
Yes. Well, what we're doing. It's been really a pleasure to work with Pearson. I've worked with them before.
I like them. They're good folks.
Release the gold standard IQ test, the WISC. And they just released another one within the last year, and I was on their advisory panel for that. And I found, wow, these are really good people. They care, and they're smart. And so, as I was mentioning earlier, I thought we needed to have an instrument to be able to put children on the path to identification. It had to be simple, quick, efficient, reliable. And which instrument should it be? Well, the person whose insights haven't been taken advantage of, but who knows the child best, who tries to help the children learn their letters and how to read, is the child's teacher. So using data from our longitudinal study where we had a teacher questionnaire, we looked at which items were the best at predicting dyslexia in as the child went on in school. We took those items and did some analysis, and we developed a kindergarten Shaywitz dyslexia screen. Who would know it had my name? And a Shaywitz dyslexia screen for first grade. They each take 5 minutes to complete. Looking at them, they're very reliable, they're very valid, inexpensive, and here, with one stroke, you can screen all the children in a class and see who is at risk right early and not wait till they fail. Because when a child has struggles in school and doesn't read well, one, they're made fun of by the other kids. Some children would rather be sent to the principal's office for bad behavior than read aloud or try to read aloud in front of their class.
Wow, yeah, of course, defense
bullied,
mechanism.
They're teased, and then they get very anxious. Oh, my God, I'm going to be called on. Oh, or it takes them long to read, and teachers, why didn't you finish this? Or they're asked to take foreign languages. which they can't do, because if you have trouble getting to the sound system of your primary language, imagine when you're trying to learn a new language. So at Yale, I'm very, very proud. We give a partial language waiver to people who are dyslexic. There's a process, a very strict process. People apply. But we're using science to impact what happens to children. So our sense is the screening measure is the answer. There are other things you have to do in teaching the children, but you have to identify who needs the help, and also so that children know that what they have has a name and that there are things they can do about it. And then they meet other children.
Idiots.
Oh, you're dyslexic too? Me too.
Yeah.
So I think I think it's just
kids are embarrassed by
paradigm shifting change forward.
It's really great. I have a question for you. All those people you named are pretty creative people, okay? Ari Emanuel, you can write down the list, John Irving, Brian Glazer, okay? And your center at Yale is called the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. And I was wondering why the end creativity is there. Why is it just the Yale Center for Dyslexia? There must be something between the two. I have this feeling.
You're right. You have very good feelings. What it is,
thank you,
is because dyslexia is a paradox. You have the difficulty reading, but you have the out-of-the-box ability to reason, to think. I'll quote you, Charles Schwab. He's been wonderful. You know, my husband, as you mentioned, is the Charles Schwab professor. And we've had conferences where he's spoken, and he said, you know, I'm able to see the end zone before other people that are thinking more literally and taking smaller steps. So dyslexic individuals, men, women, children, they have that ability, and they can make a difference in our world, but not if they drop out of school, which many, many do, not if they feel that they're stupid, And not if they get anxious or depressed. We've looked at the data. Do you know that almost half of the people in prisons, when tested, are dyslexic? Those are the ones that were ignored.
Really?
Not identified.
50% of people who are incarcerated are dyslexic.
That's when one study found.
And look what you said earlier about kids being bullies and all that, and just overcompensating in some other crazy way. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
What we've developed to sort of capture this paradox of dyslexia is what we conceptualize as a sea of strengths model. It's on page 58 of Overcoming Dyslexia, and what it shows is you can have a weakness in getting to the sounds of words and read words slowly. But that's surrounded by strengths in reasoning, critical thinking, problem solving, concept formation. So the first thing we have to do is identify the difficulty, and that won't happen if the kids aren't screened and identified.
That's right.
We talk about all the bad data coming out of education. And nobody mentions dyslexia. It's really
You're talking about 20%. You overcome that, you've eliminated the problem with 20% of the kids, which, by the way, everybody, is a lot. That's a lot.
It's huge. And it's so funny because whenever I talk to people, they know somebody, or if they see that you're knowledgeable and you're caring, they share, I think I might have that, but I've been afraid to tell people.
Sure. I have another question on that. Sally, what happens normally, and you've probably seen this 1,000 times, when you tell a parent their child is dyslexic? And the other thing I want to ask you, and I'm thinking, I'm always watching this commercial on TV. It's for some preschool thing called ABC Mouse. Okay, that your child will jump ahead in school with all this wonderful thing that's available from ABC Mouse. I'm sure it's a great product, but I don't know much about it other than that. But I'm sure it works pretty well. But and let's assume it does. But you know, parents are really concerned when their kids are really young. The kids start to operate, and all of a sudden they're just not working it out as well as the parent would like. Let's say they get a test and they're told their child is dyslexic. What's the typical parent reaction?
Well, there are two. One is fear and trepidation, because their awareness of dyslexia is, oh, my God, slow reading, it's going to be slow thinking. But please be assured I speak to them and explain. And other parents say, oh, thank goodness. I tried, you know, reading with him. I've done everything. And he's so sweet. But now he doesn't want to go to school. He tries to do his homework. It takes him all night. Oh, my God, what a sense of relief. Let's go on now. What can we do? You know, it opens the shades. I mean, and it's not only children. I recently, it's a long story and I won't bore you with it, but saw a man in his mid-50s, okay? He actually attends an online program at Yale. He lives somewhere else, but he have to come in once a month. And he was referred, and we evaluated him, and I saw he was brilliant. So I've got his phone number, his cell phone. I called him, and I said to him, you're dyslexic. Explain what it is. And said, you're very smart. You sure you got me? And then I told him he was in, you know, the high 90 percentiles for intelligence and the single figure percentiles for reading. And then I didn't hear him. And I said, are you there? And he said, I'm crying.
Oh.
And I said, so am I. And then we met. And he said, I can rethink my whole life and my whole future now. I thought I was not so smart. I can't believe this. So we have to get to children before it's sort of burnt in that you're not smart, school's not a place for you. And here we have an instrument, you know, the Shaywitz dyslexia screen, that can help identify these children before the damage is done and put them on the positive path to a beautiful future. I can't even tell you how many physicians I meet, how many businessmen, how many of everything, and the relief of parents and of the people themselves when they know what they have has a name. And many parents who struggle and then they see their child diagnosed. And Charles Schwab told me, and it's written in my book, he's in my book, Overcoming Dyslexia, he told me that he was diagnosed after his child was, and that's very common. And these parents want to make sure that their child is put on a positive pathway. We have the knowledge, and we have to use it. Our children are too precious.
Yeah, well, you got that right, and we're going to leave it at that. We got to go, but we've got the knowledge, and we have to use it. And you are, boy, dead on right, Dr. Sally Shaywitz. You are wonderful, Sally. You're really terrific. You're doing great stuff. I got
to
tell you.
Oh, I'd love to talk to you every day. it's been a real pleasure. But remember the Shaywitz Dyslexia Screen, and if you want to know more about it, Overcoming Dyslexia by Sally Shaywitz.
And that's Dr. Shaywitz, who's my guest today. Sally, you're wonderful. You and Bennett, you're going to heaven, not to worry.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
The Jewish holidays are coming up, so it's good that that's what you said.
You're clear. You don't need to buy tickets this year to synagogue. You're clear. Okay, you're good. You're already in the book. Okay, thanks, Sally. This was just great.
My pleasure.
Since you brought it up, Happy New Year.
And same to you, Lashana Tova.
Thank you, dear. You have a great day.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Sally Shaywitz. Jewish New Year's coming up, Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so we wished each other well. All right? She's a leader in, what can I say? She's a global leader, obviously, in dyslexia research. She and her husband, Bennett, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, both MDs, again, are at the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. And you just Google that. It's going to be easier than giving you the website. Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. To take you right to this great page, which has a ton of information on it. Okay. Wow. Thank you, Pearson. thank you, Lisa Wolf and Glynis, for putting this one together. This is she's a miracle lady, okay, along with her husband. Thank you very much. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org and tweet it out yet again over at EduTalk Radio. The book Sally wrote is called Overcoming Dyslexia. It's a classic, a new and complete science-based program. Science-based, we're always talking about data, science-based program for reading problems at any level. She told the story of the gentleman in his 50s. And boy, it's important because we'd be missing an awful lot of novels if John Irving couldn't get it together. I can tell you that much. We're going to archive the show, education-talkradio.org. Our schedule's up there for the week. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.